Hello, Worsford Ford listeners. Happy Halloween, one and all. And what an exciting episode this is. We have the brilliant John Gracie, the brains behind Werewolf Live and now Blood on the Clock Tower Live, performer with the Beta Males and No Rose Bard, all sorts of brilliant streaming things and comedy things and gamey things that John is involved in. And he joined us to talk about the world's worst werewolf. But before you listen to that, this is a reminder that our next live show is taking place this very Sunday, Sunday the 5th of November at midday, high noon at the Bedford Pub in Southwest London as part of the Cheerful Earful Podcast Festival. We are doing a live show all about the world's worst siblings with our special guests, the excellent Laura Lex, returning after, God, few years absence from the podcast. Laura is joining us with her brother Ron. They host the podcast Lex Education, where Ron, who is not a comedian but is very clever, educates Laura on everything she's forgotten since her GCSEs, and they are bringing their sibling rivalry to the Worst Foot Forward podcast, and we are so excited to have them. So if you want to join us on Sunday, we'd love to see you there as well. God damn it. It's, you know, it's a tricky old slot midday on a Sunday. But we think, actually, you know what? If you're around London, if you can come watch a little podcast and then have a lovely Sunday lunch afterwards, there are worse ways to spend your day. And there are tickets still available. If you head to cheerfulearful.co.uk, click the lineup and tickets bit and you'll see the Worst Foot Forward logo. And proceed from there. The link is in the description of this episode. Aside from that, all the usual stuff. Follow us on social media at Worst Foot on Instagram and on the site formerly known as Twitter. Give us a shout out. Spread the news about the live show. Spread the news about the podcast. Drop us a lovely review. You can review us on iTunes. You can review us on Spotify. You can review us in all sorts of places. A couple of nice reviews have been dropped lately. We appreciate those from those of you who've been writing them. And you know, recommend us to a friend. If the least you can offer us, well, that is more than a little. And finally, of course, if you want to support us monetarily, then you can do so on Patreon. Patreon.com/worstfootforward. Chuck us a few quid. There's bonus content there. There's some extra interview stuff with John on there coming up this week. And more of that with other past guests. There'll be bits of Ben's stand-up and extracts from the book we're still slaving away on. And other bits and bobs, and they help keep the lights on. They're how we pay ourselves. We don't have any ads on the podcast, so if you want to help keep us cranking the wheel here at Worst Foot Forward Towers, then patreon.com/worstfootforward is the way to go. But most importantly of all, please, 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 if you can make it, join us on Sunday for our live show with Laura Lex and Ron. And I'm really looking forward to it. I can't wait. God damn, love doing these live, and we love seeing you there. So hopefully there'll be a bunch of Worst Foot Forwarders. Worst Foot Forwarders, what's the collective? Have we got a sort of a, like a group name? Maybe drop us a suggestion on social media. What do we call listeners of Worst Foot Forward? A clump? A posse? A menagerie? Who knows? Anyway, while I'm mulling that, get your ears stuck into our episode with John Gracie about the world's worst werewolf. Ow!
Welcome, friends, lovers, and lycanthropes, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vandervelde, and this week you join us in Transylvania for the infamous undead answer to Crofts, Rufts. Coming up soon, we'll have the obstacle course where competitors will have to slalom between crucifixes while avoiding silver bullets and sprays of holy water. There's the finest pelt competition, most elegant transition, and the eating competition where entrants who can consume the most judges in under 60 seconds will be crowned the victor. Excuse me. The We Are Winner. But before that, it's time to introduce my co-host. He is the elongated fingers to my cracking joints, the teen wolf to my wolf man, and the howling beast to my full moon. It's Barry McStay.
Ow!
That, you know that werewolves are such excellent cheerleaders.
They could have been hosts of Gladiators as well. That's the real shame.
Oh, I would. Oh my God, that's an incredibly dated 90s reference. Well done, you. I would love to see a mythical creature version of Gladiators, where
the real wolf.
The real wolf man. Yeah.
I was reading about sort of various werewolf films in preparation for this, and they've sort of they've had a slightly more glamorous vibe in the, was it 70s or 80s when An American Werewolf in Paris came out. I always thought it would be very different if you'd pick different nations for that, if you had like a Swiss werewolf in Ouagadougou or something like that. Sort of, it's not quite as like, ooh, sexy and hairy and continental.
Yeah, well, obviously like a Turkish werewolf, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between the human form and the male form.
We're really expanding the podcast reach.
It's not xenophobic. Turkish people famously are quite hairy.
No, feathers. Turkeys have feathers, Ben.
Oh, yes. That's the mistake. That is the mistake.
We're clearly neither of us experts in werewolves whatsoever. But we've got an expert of sorts on the show who spent a lot of time delving into what makes a good werewolf or not. Our guest this week is a comic performer, writer, director, and all-round king of the world of games. So expect him to stand arms outstretched at the front of the Titanic trying to figure out how to turn it into a big old game of battleship. He has designed multiple live immersive games like escape rooms, as well as games you can take home in a little box in his mini mysteries, and mega games like Bring Them Home, all about safely returning astronauts to planet Earth, though one wonders what makes Earth so appealing these days. And he runs the brilliant werewolf live shows for those of you who like the idea of lying to your friends and ultimately devouring them. He similarly recently started hosting Blood in the Clock Tower Live for a similar brand of people who enjoy smearing bodily fluids on horological devices. He has written songs with friend of the show Jay Foreman, as well as a successful YouTube series Politics Unboringed, has directed the live shows of other friends of our show Grubby Little Mitts, and is a regular on the gaming channel No Rose Bard and his own Twitch channel. He has really got this work thing licked. Make it about what you love. He also once hosted a podcast about vomit stories called The Vomitorium. Make it about what you love. Please welcome the very game, John Gracie.
Wow, you really went to my website, didn't you?
I really went to your website. I got on the tube, went into town, walked several streets down some dingy steps, got a Wi-Fi box and logged onto your website.
So my website is johngracie.com, but if you type johngracie.com, it forwards to what my website really is, which is johngracie.sexy.
Yes.
I paid real money to have, and I'm delighted about it.
It brings in the people who are there for games and the other people who are looking for sexy John Gracies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, how are you two? Are you well?
We're very good, and we're delighted to have you. We've had a recent run of people of your ilk on the show, with the Grubby Little Mitts joining us, and Ivan Brett of The Traitors as well. So we're really leaning into the nerd like demographic of the show.
Yeah, nerds get very anxious if you lean into them. They don't like it. They feel they don't like where it's gonna lead.
Yeah. How about telling us about Werewolf Live? Lots of people will know what Werewolf the game is, but lots of people won't.
Similar to The Traitors in that it's a bluffing game. Werewolf was designed initially, it was called Mafia. It was a game invented by a Russian psychologist. They were doing a degree in psychology and kind of group dynamics, and they wanted to create a game that kind of examined how people operated in groups with small amounts of information and how that spread.
Badly. They operate badly.
Yeah. The conclusion was, not well. and then that was turned into a game by some Princeton students. They basically reworked Mafia into Werewolf, which is what it kind of is now. But basically, small group of people are the evil players, and they know who the other evil players are, but they are hidden. And the rest of the group are trying to figure out who the liars are. And the liars are incentivized to stay hidden and say that they're not liars. And everyone else is trying to figure out who the liars are. And I do that as a live show where I dress up in a cloak. And it's a very silly German village with a name that the audience decides. So inevitably is filthy. And we watch people try and ascertain who the truth tellers are and who the liars are. And it's very entertaining.
I love how this basically started out as academia and turned into game. I'm just waiting for someone to go, hey, how about we go for Milgram Experiment, the game? And we can just have...
That's Operation, isn't it?
Oh my God, if we did Operation, but with a live person that you're operating on.
The stakes are so high.
Yeah. But it's... it is amazing to me how, you know, the Traitors come along and people are like, oh, this is a revolutionary new show. But humans are like, there's a long line of these shows where people lie to each other about the, I mean, I remember the mole came back on Netflix last
yes.
year. The Mole was around in the early 2000s. The Mafia game is even older than that. Humans like these games where you lie to each other, you pretend to be something you're not. It's a very it taps into something I think quite childish in all of us.
Yeah, because I've played it, I've run the game, I think probably quite literally thousands of times now across like all over the world, and I've played it with tiny children right up to my grandparents, who at the time were like 88, 89, and watching all the kind of experience of humanity just being like, oh, I just have to lie, that's the whole game, and they're just settling in and just seeing how yes. they go about that simple task with their own particular understanding of what a convincing lie is and what a convincing yeah. way of reading someone else is so, so interesting, because like the brief is really simple, but the way it is executed is just endlessly fascinating and different.
I imagine watching how grandparents lie to their grandchildren will be different at seeing how comedians lie to sketch performers compared to yeah. how CEOs laugh to lie to their front of house staff.
Yeah. Watching my granddad, who was, yeah, he's 88 at the time, quite a, like, serious man, watching him and my mum, who were the two werewolves, just masterfully, like, spin a web of deceit across the entire family. My mum chose to kill my brother. And then when my brother died, my mum was like, oh, I could never kill one of my babies. That couldn't be me. I was like, well, you just did. I watched you as the games master. You murdered your son in cold blood and then fell back on the defense of, but he's my child, I could never do that. And everyone believed it, and she won, and it was phenomenal.
It does reveal what your inner, like your go-to evil avatar is. Because I remember playing a game of Resistance, a very similar game on my birthday 1 year with a group of people, including my husband and Ben and his wife, and myself and Ben's wife were the evil players 2 games in a row. Both times, what we did was span a web of lies, implicating one other person, and turn the entire group on them. So I guess conniving, happy to throw people under the bus is my inner evil avatar.
Did you ever do the thing of like, well, I was evil last time, so come on,
can't
I'm
possibly
not gonna be evil this time.
The law of averages say it could never happen that it would be me again.
It works a shocking amount of times
yes.
where people just go, well, I mean, statistically, I can't be evil twice.
Yeah.
I'm not sure you understand statistics, but the group doesn't either, so you're fine.
Yeah.
It's just, I wonder how many marriages, friendship groups, and limited companies the game of Werewolf has destroyed.
The really interesting thing, and I think my like hard line on how ethically to play, is that you can never bring in the outside world into the game.
Yeah.
So if you say, you can maybe say like, I swear on my life, if you really want, knowing that that's like not an actual thing. But if you start saying stuff like I swear on my mum's life, or you start to like bring in the real world and real stakes, if you are then lying, it's okay if you're not lying, but if you are then lying. So we had like a family friend's partner came to the family Christmas, and we were playing Secret Hitler, which is very similar, but it's fascists and liberals instead of werewolves and villagers. It's an interesting choice for the game.
Speaking culturally, I'd rather play Secret Pol Pot, and I'm so sorry to my Cambodian friends.
Just whoever's just wearing glasses
yes!
immediately kills. But he got genuinely angry at when he was accused, even though it was looking quite like he was either the fascist or Hitler. But we kind of had his number because there's a little bit more data in Secret Hitler. You have a bit more work, more stuff to play with. And then it turned out we ended up feeling a bit bad, and so we didn't get him. And then he won. And he really crowed about it afterwards. I was like, oh, bro, you made us feel really bad because we don't know you very well.
Yeah.
And then you were really smug when you won. But you kind of won. It felt like it wasn't quite in the spirit of the game. And that's
yeah.
I think that's where you got to be careful. As long as you keep it within the realms of the game, I think it's absolutely fine to do whatever you want. But as soon as you start to kind of, the emotion bleeds out to the real world, that's where it can get a bit tricky.
Just
yeah.
like test matches, you have to maintain the spirit of Werewolf. And
yeah,
that spirit goes, woo!
But I think that's why having a good moderator, someone who's comedic like yourself, who sort of brings in an element of silliness with the silliness of the name of the
video. Yes, absolutely. To remind everyone how stupid this whole thing is.
Wearing a stupid cloak, which you probably
yeah.
secretly think makes you look cool.
Yeah.
Oh, I absolutely do, yeah.
So we know John that you are excellent at facilitating lies between loved ones, but what are you bad at?
Just before the call started, I had a few things written down, but I was like, my wife was asleep because she's not feeling very well. But I thought, I'll ask her before the podcast starts because she'll know. And then I mentioned the things that I'd said and she absolutely agreed, which is comforting in a way. But the things I'm worst at, sleeping quietly is one.
Ooh, you're a snorer.
I snore so much.
Oh, dude.
It's absolutely off the chain. I wrote a play in 2018 it was a comedy courtroom drama where the final bit of evidence, or one of the really crucial bits of evidence, was someone who's an incredibly loud snorer, and they played it in the courtroom to be like, how could the other person have slept through this snoring? And Viv just recorded me snoring one night, and we used that in the play. And everyone was like, yeah, and that's the snoring of a very unwell man. That clearly fits this narrative. And it was just a random 10 seconds that she recorded me sleeping.
Oh,
so,
my God.
Awful, truly awful. And but not for me. I love it.
You take great pride in your, I mean, in the fact that you sound like broken agricultural machinery.
Absolutely. And the crucial thing is that Viv, my wife, just has to get to sleep before I do. And then she's fine.
No.
It doesn't wake her up if she's already asleep. But if I'm asleep first, then
the race is on.
Yeah, the race is on to get to sleep. Luckily, she's a very, very good, annoyingly good sleeper. Out in 5 seconds, like a log, for 8 hours every night.
You've trained her to do that.
She already was good, but I've definitely tested her skills to the absolute limit.
I take ages to fall asleep. I can take 2 or 3 hours. I'll get through like
2 or 3 hours.
I'm a big fan of the Oxventure podcast, the D&D podcast, and I'll often go, well, I listen to an episode of this, and I'll fall asleep before the end of the episode. And when I'm still awake, as they're doing the end of the podcast, like chat, I'm like, I'm going to have to load up another episode now because it's going to end and there's going to be silence and then I'll just be lying here with my thoughts and my husband snoring next to me.
Is it because it's compelling though, that it's keeping you awake?
No, when I was younger, I was much better at fall asleep listening to audiobooks or Radio 4 palindromes and things like that. But I've just gotten, I think it's probably growing old and having more cares, John.
Oh dear, don't do that.
Never, don't recommend it. Yeah. Have you ever listened to the Sleep, I think it's called Sleep With Me podcast?
I have tried Sleep With Me. He's got such a weird voice.
Yeah, if you don't know this one, Ben, it's designed by a guy to be as, like, falling asleep friendly as possible.
Okay.
And he's got all these techniques, like, it can't be completely boring, because then you stop engaging. So it has to be just have enough narrative, or it can't just be random, because then you don't latch onto it. It has to be just enough interest that your brain listens to it, but also not in any way exciting, so that you get revved up and can't fall asleep. So he's kind of treading this very fine line, and the episodes are like 3 hours long. They're meandering and slow, but with just enough that you don't completely detach, and it's a really interesting balance that he's cultivating.
Yeah, I imagine it is.
So we should definitely have him on the podcast and see how many of our listeners make it through to the end.
Yeah.
Obviously, we are talking about the world's worst werewolf.
Halloween is coming.
Oh my God, they should totally do that with a werewolf on the back of the Coca-Cola truck drinking someone's blood. And Barry,
giving a cheeky wink to a child in the background.
Yes, you're next, Junior. Just looking at the child going, oh, tapas. So, Barry, you're going to go first. Yeah.
Yes, I am going first. I mean, I didn't, up until today, know what the were bit in werewolf meant. it means man. It's the old English for man, were.
So were you confused by Sonic the Hedgehog, Curse of the Werehog? Yes. Which means Curse of the Manhog.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Very
That's so
different.
Right. Curse the the were-rabbit. All of those, yeah. It's not. They've got the wrong bit of the word.
Yeah.
Warehouse, part house, part man. So yeah, it's not just men. There's quite a lot of were-women and things like that in
man women
mythologies. But it doesn't sound right when you say woman-wolf somehow.
No.
Part woman, part CNN news anchor.
When we were on holiday, there was a woman who had swum out to one of the rocks and we were at the beach, and I pointed her out to my son and went, oh, look, mate, it's a mermaid. And he turned to me and went, oh, it might be a man-maid. And I said,
think about it, Ben.
Yeah, I sussed it. And I said to him, why don't you go swim out and tell her that? And he drowned.
I read about a chap called Jean de Nino, who was a Nino, appropriately, a French physician.
Yeah. Are you sure he wasn't a French ambulance?
Yeah. He wrote a work on lycanthropy called On Lycanthropy, Transformation and Ecstasy of Witches in 1615. Ooh. And he saw lycanthropy as a sort of a mental illness. And there was a story reported in this book about a man being attacked at night by a wolf. And he wounded the wolf and cut off the paw. And then the next day, a woman was found with her hand missing, which identified her as the werewolf. One of the articles I read about this said this story probably recommended itself to some men as the perfect way to dispose of women they had mistreated. Mm. So, as with so many of these mythologies, when there's women involved, there's usually terrible men behind.
Yes. How can I dispose of women in minorities? Ah, folklore. Here you come again.
Yeah.
In 1591, apparently there was a broadside published called The Werewolves of Uruk. Mm-hmm. Which tells of hundreds of werewolves and of men and women being executed, including women wearing nuns' veils. And there's a legend from Liberia of a lazy husband asking his wife to use shape-shifting powers and change into a leopard and capture food.
Ooh,
to
a leopard.
Help. Yeah, so a were-leopard. a werewoman leopard. And she transforms, but instead she terrorizes the husband and gets him to go hunting instead.
Great.
Oh, so that's just a matter of a woman getting man to do any work whatsoever.
And well, it's the man going, you've got special powers, why don't you do all the work? And she goes, I think you'll find I'll use my powers to terrorise you into doing work.
Yeah, yeah.
Lycanthropy is a modern psychological disorder. Mm-hmm. It's a genuine belief that some patients have where they think they're turning into a beast. Usually whatever the local alpha predator is, so it might be wolves in Europe. It might be lions or in Africa or tigers in Southern Asia and things like that.
What they should do is, you know, obviously you get people who have got delusions that they are Hitler, is that they should put those people in the room with the people who think they are wolves and then get the wolf to eat Hitler. I submit my paper to the Royal Society of Physicians.
There's another condition that I read about which might shed some light on where the legend of werewolves comes from as well, is hypertrichosis, which is a genetic disorder which causes excessive hair growth. There's one particularly famous figure called Petrus Gonsalves, the man in the woods, who was born in 1537, who was found basically to have hair all over his body, and he was taken into the court of a French king, and then he went to the court of Margaret of Parma, and he married quite well. He married a Lady Catherine, and they had 7 children, I think, 4 of whom also had hair all over their bodies. The marriage between him and Lady Catherine is apparently thought to be one of the inspirations for the tale of Beauty and the Beast. But there's a portrait of him and several paintings of his children in the Chamber of Art and Curiosities at Ambras Castle in Austria. So hypertrichosis is also known as Ambras syndrome because of the multitude of paintings in that castle.
Right. Also known as Hairyitis from Theme Hospital.
Hairyitis from Theme Hospital, yes.
Put them in the electrolysis machine, zap them off.
Yeah. And I read about Peter the Wild Boy as well, who I'm sure both of you might have heard of. He was 12 years old when, in 1725, he was found wandering on all fours through a German forest near the town of Hamelin. Yes, that town of Hamelin. And the hunt was being led by the English king, George I. And there was this kid living feral. They thought he might have been a werewolf, or at least raised by wolves. He survived by eating forest flora with his bare hands. He walked on all fours. He couldn't be taught to learn any languages. And he had various facial features like a flattened nose and prominent jaw, and he had difficulty breathing and things. Modern researchers think he probably had a thing called Pitt-Hopkins syndrome, which wasn't discovered until 1978, so that's 250 years later. But he was taken in by George I and George II, and he lived out his days as kind of their pet, which is a little bit gross, but he lived quite a long life in England. And Pitt-Hopkins syndrome or hypertrichosis are two conditions that may be the cause of some of the legends of werewolves. But then I began to read a little bit about film werewolves, and so much of what we think of with like stereotypical werewolves comes from film.
Mm-hmm.
Like the silver bullets thing, that's not an old thing at all. The Wolfman in 1941, that the Lon Chaney film, introduced, I think he gets whacked over the head with a silver tipped cane in that. But the idea of using silver to ward off wolves is very much a Hollywood thing. There is one story from a writer called J.D.H. Tem, who wrote Folk Tales of Pomerania and Rügen in 1840. And he tells the story of the German city of Greifswald, which was freed from werewolves in the 1600s by locals melting their silverware to make silver bullets. But even as I say, that story comes from the 1840s, so it's a much later invention. The same author, by the way, has a story about how werewolves were fond of attacking horses, and in a village called Bork, one man made his entire living by walking around horse pastures, whispering words to horses to protect them from werewolves.
Okay, a couple of issues to that. Firstly, the town is called Bork, as in the main part of the Swedish chef's vocabulary.
Yeah, I think it was named after him or after the failed US Supreme Court nominee in the late 1980s.
Yes, of course. And obviously he wrote a song about it called Bork Bork, so good they named it twice.
Yeah.
And secondly, a dude managed to hustle a job essentially as a coach for horses, ironically.
Yes, as he was a horse whisperer. He was paid to walk. He was paid by villagers to go into the fields, whisper in horses' ears. And I bet as the money jingled in his pockets, he whispered to those horses, "Your owner's a fucking idiot."
Yeah, yeah. Just with them, "I can't believe I'm getting away with this.
Away with this.
Thanks, Black Beauty. This is great."
Yeah. contagious lycanthropy, the idea that if you're bit by a werewolf, you become a werewolf. That's a Hollywood thing as well. It also doesn't make much sense because, you know, if the werewolf needs to feed on you, on your flesh, it doesn't make sense to turn you into another... Yeah, it doesn't want to turn you into an equally powerful werewolf.
Like, ultimately, everyone would be a werewolf if that
was
the case.
Yeah, exactly.
It would spread exponentially.
If you want to turn into a werewolf, these are some suggestions. J.D.H. Tem, the person I just mentioned, he said you can turn into a werewolf by wearing a strap that has been cut from the back of a man who's been hanged.
As in, like, skin?
Yeah, like a belt or some sort of, strapping around you.
As in, like, but made from the...
The hide of a hanged man.
Oh. Yeah, there's a lot of that and a lot of wearing wolf pelts to take on the powers of werewolves and things like that. But yeah, there's a lot in Northwestern Europe about having a wolf strap, sort of like basically they're the sort of undead where in order to become them you have to accessorize correctly.
Yeah. You could also drink rain water out of the footprint of a wolf. If you're Swedish, you could drink some specially prepared beer. And if you're French, you could become a loup-garou, as they call them in France, by sleeping outside on a summer night with a full moon shining directly on your face. But the full moon thing, again, is kind of a Hollywood thing. The Wolfman film of 1941, again, has a rhyme in it, which is, "Even a man who is pure in heart and says his prayers by night may become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the autumn moon is bright." And that gets repeated in lots of the subsequent Lon Chaney Wolfman films, although they do change the autumn moon to "the moon is full and bright" because I think they decided sometimes they wanted to set it at other times of the year.
Yeah.
And also it's often shown as incurable in films, that someone's a werewolf, they can't be turned back. But actually a lot of folklore suggests there are like various wolfsbanes or different surgeries and remedies you could carry out instead. Though obviously the surgery usually cures them of being a wolf by curing them of being alive as well. But I've gone through a lot of mythology and things, and the worst wolf I've hit upon is the beast of Gévaudan, a French beast. And this is already a clue as to why I think this is a terrible werewolf. A man-eating animal or animals that terrorized the former province of Gévaudan in southern France in the 1760s. So already you can spot, was there a werewolf or was there just lots of wolves?
Yeah.
Because there was a lot of attacks, covering an area of 90 kilometres by 80 kilometres was the area within which this was said to take place. And there was a beast was always said to have been carrying these out, with a dark colour down its back and a long tail with a tuft on the end of it.
I'm out if a werewolf has a tufty tail. That is far too Beatrix Potter for me.
Well, actually, one of the suggestions is that it was a lion escaped from a menagerie, when the tufty tail kind of ties in with that.
What is the purpose of the little tuft on a lion's tail? Feels very cute for a...
Yeah, to look adorable, so that before it's consumed, the prey's like, "Oh, this guy's all right."
It's like how all the generals in Zulu in those films have like little fly swishers.
Oh, yeah, it might be a fly thing.
Oh, yeah, I'm the king of the beasts, but I got to keep those flies away, man. It's hard to look this good. Other suggestions that maybe it was hyenas, or a large wolf or wolves. A 1987 study estimates from various reports there were maybe 210 attacks by this animal, resulting in 113 deaths. Other sources claim between 60 and 100 people being eaten or killed. They were often killed by having their throats torn out. The beast was reported dead several times before the attack stopped. So the Kingdom of France and various local nobles spent so much money trying to track this thing down over such a long period of time. Like I said, there were lots of different attacks. The terror was beginning to strike, so the local nobility decided that they had to do something about it. And it came to the attention of King Louis XV. He awarded 300 livres to a chap called Jacques Portefeuille, who was attacked along with his children, and they drove the beast away, or they said they'd driven it away. He also gave him an education at the state's expense for doing good work and trying to keep the people safe. And then the king said the French state would help find and kill the beast. And the story had spread around Europe. Like I say, the number of attacks was so high that there were English journalists making fun of the royal family of France for not being able to deal with this. A local bishop had to deal with bags and bags of not fan mail, but mail from people all over France suggesting various methods for dealing with this werewolf.
I love it.
This and, is incredible. It's like suddenly the Fortean Times was the premier newspaper in France.
Yes. But it's very much like this wolf was like France's most wanted. They literally had court artists issue depictions of the beast. So everyone would be like, so they'd know what to look for, but also so people would be less scared by it when they saw it in real life because they'd already seen a picture
of
it.
But also surely it was a, have you seen this naughty doggy?
Yes. Well, it's funny you mentioned dogs. They trained packs of hunting dogs to chase the beast by making a cardboard effigy of the beast.
Wow.
So we had people like the captain of the Clermont Prince Dragoons and his troops were sent to Gévaudan. A bit like the sort of the people who nowadays might be saying ACAB, all the locals did not cooperate with them. So instead, the king sent two professional wolf hunters, Jean-Charles Marc-Antoine Vaumel Deneval and his son Jean-Francois. And they hunted for various Eurasian wolves, believing that maybe an outsized Eurasian wolf was behind the attacks. So they killed loads of wolves and still the attacks continued. Then they sent in the king's sole arquebus bearer, an arquebus being an early rifle. And the king had one rifle bearer. He sent him to the region. And then he organized a great hunt. It was like when there's a missing person and they get all of the locals to go like walking through fields and forests trying to find them. They got all the locals to try and find this beast. And there was a woman called Marie-Jeanne Vallée who apparently fought off the beast on a bridge and speared it and managed to make it dive into the water of a river. And they kept tracking the beast nearby where the attack had happened. And a couple of days later, Antoine killed a big grey wolf, Leloup de Chaz. It was named after a nearby abbey. And he said he was certain this must be it because of the scars in his body, which matched up with the scars that were inflicted by Marie-Jeanne Vallée. And so great, they sent the animal on a horse and cart to Clermont and then had it stuffed and arrived at Versailles along with Francois Antoine. He was hailed as a hero and they exhibited the beast. And he and his father received various monies and titles. And a little while later, the attacks began again.
Oh no!
They had just killed another wolf. I mean, who knows whether it's the same wolf, different wolves, but at this point they're just like, oh god, more wolves.
Did they not realise that wolves are pack animals, so just killing one wolf isn't going to be enough?
Well, what they did then was they thought, we need, and it wouldn't be a Worstwood Ford podcast without some dead dogs, they decided they would poison some dogs' corpses and lay them along the hunting grounds that these wolves seem to operate in to try and poisoned the beast, and that again proved ineffective. So eventually, the attack that seems to have done the job was a local hunter called Jean Chastel. He shot another big animal on the slopes of a mountain. There is a story that he used bullets made of Virgin Mary's medals, which is a literary invention from the 1940s. He just shot it with normal bullets, as you do.
Virgin Mary's medals?
Yeah. She was a very good Olympian, the Virgin Mary.
Yeah. Third place in shot put.
Yeah. But he had the body sent to Paris as well to show to the king. The king was away, so they needed to wait a few days. So it was kept in the grounds of the Marquis de la Rochefoucauld. And apparently the corpse smelt so badly in the summer heat that rather than waiting for the king to get back, they just buried it.
Oh, I can't imagine.
Gilbert, the servant who had been who had accompanied the beast, was apparently so sick by the smell of the corpse while he was waiting for the king to return that he was bedridden for 15 days. And he suffered from a disease for 6 years afterwards.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So the attacks finished after this. For various reasons, probably because it's lots of wolves and not one wolf, probably because it took multiple efforts to kill it a bit like Rasputin, because of the humiliation poured on the French by various different journalists, because of the fact it probably was actually a lion instead of a wolf, and because it ended up with a stinky corpse poisoning a servant in Paris, I've gone for the Beast of Gévaudan as my world's worst werewolf.
Got a little two-parter, because we were talking about werewolf films, and I found the worst werewolf transformation scene by a country mile. Is there a way we can watch this? What I would love is for you to watch it and then describe what you're seeing on screen for the people.
If you send us the link and we'll hit go at the same time.
Yeah, so this is from a Thai film called Werewolf. Spoke to my friend B, who is Thai, and she has agreed that I can play... This is how it's pronounced in Thai, because I wasn't going to pronounce it myself, because... You don't want to hear that. So this is the name of the film, which is the word werewolf in Thai.
Ah.
Hello, John. Werewolf in Thai. We say manut ma pa.
So that's the name of the film. So this is the transformation scene. Start playing together, and then I would like you to describe what you see.
I'm ready. 3, 2, 1.
Okay, there is a Thai gentleman sat in what appears to be a cave, and...
A dog's just walked by.
Yeah, zoomed in on him.
It's just a dog.
It's just a dog, it's just a black dog. He has opened his eyes now and is looking at the dog. The dog's looking at him. He's looking at the dog. Bit more intense.
They're having a staring match.
The dog has put lasers into the man's eyes, and now... Bits of black fluff are appearing all over his body. And now he's got a very pantomimish dog's head on. And, oh, good Lord. And it's now... There's no elongated limbs. There's no sort of extension of his body in any way. He's just been zapped into wheel form by a little homeless dog.
That is so good. It cuts back and forth between the staring match, a bit like the TIE fighter and Luke on the Millennium Falcon, like multiple times. And then the dog, it cuts to a still of the dog doing the laser eyes, like the cat laser meme. And Ben was generous when he said bits of fur are appearing on the man's body. I think it's fair to say a time lapse where in between which multiple makeup artists glue another patch of fur to the man's skin takes place.
Yes. Yeah. So that's the worst transformation I've seen by a country.
Yeah, it's worst in such a terrific homemade way. It's incredibly endearing.
Yeah,
it's got some very good, like slightly theremin-y music in the background, which makes it sound.
Yeah, the music's good.
As is often the case with these things, they're meant to be the most terrifying moment of the film, and it absolutely misses that mark.
I think the very start there, where it's just a man staring at an actual dog, that has with the music, I found it like, oh, this is a bit unsettling. I don't know what's going to happen here, and then it completely shits the bed. I'm also going to send you the actual movie poster, which is the fucking raddest thing you've ever seen. So,
great.
Let me find that. I've got it on my desktop. It is.
I think werewolf transformations are kind of a later Hollywood thing. You don't see a lot of the transformations in the early Hollywood films. They're either already a man who is a man wolf. Or it happens on screen. I'm not sure until it's the 70s, 80s things that they were confident enough in their transformation skills.
Yeah. So this is, again, from the same film. Hopefully we can share the link for that little clip so people can watch it at home.
Yes, absolutely. I will stick that in the description of the podcast. I have to say, the YouTube title for the video that you sent us, John, is Greatest Werewolf Transformation Scene Ever, just to be clear.
And in many ways, it's hard to argue against that. Let's look at this werewolf post.
Oh, wow. The poster is very sexy.
It's really cool. Got a fully naked man mid-transformation, and just the head is the wolf, and he's also holding a shotgun.
I mean, there's a woman below him who it seems is fully naked as well, lying covered partially by some clouds.
Yeah.
Reaching up in such a way that says, no, don't touch me, but also touch me.
the production values really went into the poster rather than the film itself.
The girl from The Ring seems to be standing on a cliff on the right-hand side.
Yeah, she does. And the werewolf is... firstly, like you say, it looks like he's got two arms, one of which is a shotgun. And very sort of styled hair in the head, and then a weirdly buff body and tiny little goat legs.
Yeah, he is fucking cut on his upper half. He's got those cum gutters for days.
He does, but good Lord, Jonathan. But he very much... he skipped leg day quite a lot at the werewolf gym.
He did.
The thing I quite like about it is that every actor on the poster is giving a lot of like very good fakes, except bottom right. The woman in the very bottom right looks like she's part of an improv troupe.
Yeah.
Just been given a slightly weird audience suggestion.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, she's a bit disconcerted, isn't she? Yeah.
She is. She's popped out from an advert for Thailand's premier supermarket chain. Like everyone else is in the movie, and she is in the pre-show adverts. Although to be fair, the dude above her, who is there's two dudes who look like classic action movie ass kickers, and then clearly there's whimsical comedy sidekick who appears to be wearing a massive white wig and smoking a pipe. I don't know what he's doing there.
Yeah,
but I also like the woman on the left with the world's longest legs.
Yeah, she's got very long legs and no neck.
Yeah.
But I noticed very, like, to the left of those long legs appears to be two zombies crawling out of the dirt. And also on the right, you may have mentioned this before, I think my internet cut out. That looks a bit like the lady from The Ring.
Mm. Yeah, it is. Just hanging out on the rock. She's absolutely there. They chucked in a few bonus monsters.
So it's really got everything.
Yeah. Encourage people wholeheartedly to go find the poster for this.
Yeah, it's rad.
Again, we'll stick it on our socials when this episode comes out. Amazing. Oh,
so that was the best worst werewolf I could find in terms of transformations. But I did also look up a historical werewolf, similar-ish period to what you're talking about with your stuff, Barry. But I'd like to tell you about the Werewolf of Bedburg.
Oh,
yes, please. Life is like a hurricane. Here in Bedburg.
It's really it's worst in a way that. It's really upsetting. Like it's an awful, bad, terrible story. So this is a guy called Peter Stump. He goes by many names, but Peter Stump is kind of the one that's most used. Could also be Peter Stube, Peter Stubb, Peter Stumpf. A bit like how Donald Trump's real name is Drumpf, but he changed it to Trump. So we've got Peter Stump is one option. Maybe the same lineage based on what he's about to do. Who knows? There could be
almost
a connection.
Almost certainly.
There.
Yeah. I mean, the hair all over the body in weird way places.
Yes.
Makes
the
sense.
The terrible treatment of everyone. So Peter Stump apparently, supposedly called similar to the story you were telling, Barry, in that he his left hand was a stump. And one of the wolves that they found also had its left forepaw was a stump. And so they, of course, even though it would be very easy if you knew someone with a missing limb, it would be very easy to create or abuse a wolf to make it look like the person you wanted to frame. Either way, they drew a connection and said, that's definitely the same guy. So he was from
irrefutable
Eprath.
Evidence.
Exactly. He's from a town called Eprath, which is near Cologne, like west of Cologne. He was born in around the 1530s. We don't know for sure. It's interesting. The documentation for this comes from, there was an initial German document, which has been lost, but there was an English translation made. And one of the sole remaining copies lives in the British Museum. And it was discovered in the 20s. I think it was written... It was written in the 1590, but the only surviving copy was discovered by Montaigne Summers, who was one of the occultists. I think he was one of the Crowley lot, but he was discovered in the '20s.
Friend of the show, Aleister Crowley.
Yep, it's one in the British Museum, one in the Lambeth Library. But so it was written in the 1590s, based on German accounts, and there's like an alderman of this town who's given some thoughts, but basically it's a series of events that have been recounted, but. Here's what happened. So, Peter Stump, born in around 1530, and in 1589, so he's 59 at this point. And bear in mind, this is after being stretched out on the rack, which I have a feeling I would say anything if I was stretched out on the rack. You know, have you seen the famous like Guy Fawkes signature that when you studied history at school, where you like see his handwriting pre-torture and then afterwards, and it's like, this is a man that didn't have a choice about what he signed.
No.
He did it or not, it's kind of like...
Actually, that signature was done by my five-year-old son. That's just all that happened there. It's not a man who's been tortured. Yeah. It's just a preschooler.
So anyway, he was stretched on the rack and confessed all this stuff afterwards. So take that for what you will. But he confessed to having practiced black magic since he was 12. And crucially, this is interesting in terms of how transformations happen. He claimed that the way he was able to transform into a wolf was because he was given a belt by the devil, a girdle or a belt, and when he put it on, he would transform into a wolf-like creature. There's a great quote here. So the devil, he claimed the devil had given him a magical belt which enabled him to metamorphose into, quote, the likeness of a greedy, devouring wolf, strong and mighty, with eyes great and large, which in the night sparkled like fire, a mouth great and wide with most sharp and cruel teeth, a huge body and mighty paws.
Sexy.
And so, pretty hot, right? You can see where the sexy stuff comes from.
Yeah.
And so he claims that when he removed the belt, he would transform back into his human form. And he did tell the local magistrate where he'd left the belt, in a certain valley, is the quote, but they couldn't find it. So, you know, read into that what you will. But his alleged crimes were 25 years of being, quote, an insatiable bloodsucker, gorged on the flesh of animals and humans. And this is where it gets really grim. So just if you don't like hearing about really bad things, I would suggest stopping listening. This was after he was threatened with torture, but he confessed, whether this is true or not, he confessed to eating 14 children.
Uh-oh.
This is really bad. I'm not going to go. It's too bad. I'm reading it out now. It's awful. It's really horrible, which is why I say worst in terms of ethically worst, as opposed to not very good. He also ate his son, apparently, and he was accused of having an incestuous relationship with his daughter, who was, according to the laws at the time, sentenced to die with him, because it was her fault, apparently. And he also confessed to fucking a succubus, sent him by the devil. So, you know, maybe this is true, maybe not.
I'm enjoying that you're keeping your mind open on this.
I'm just like, if ever anyone confesses to a thing after torture, I'm just like, how much is any of this true? But also, you know, maybe there were loads of deaths and it was really obviously this guy. He was executed on Halloween night, as in October... is it 31st or 30th Halloween?
It's the 31st.
31st. It's a bit on the nose, yeah. That, executing him on Halloween, though, isn't it?
I know. How cool is that, though? Halloween night, 1589.
Trick or treat.
Yeah. He was executed alongside his daughter, which is really rough, because she didn't fucking do anything. And his mistress, Catherine. We don't know what she did, but they were executed. And the torture was one of the most brutal on record. Are you familiar with the wheel as a torture device?
Vaguely.
Yeah. Yeah, essentially, they get a big, like, wagon wheel and just, like, continually drop it on you to, like, break your bones. The idea being to injure you but not kill you. And then when you're kind of mangled up, from what I can tell, they kind of, like, weave you through the, like, spokes of the wheel, which is just grisly.
No thanks.
He was put to the wheel, and then the flesh was torn from his body in 10 places by red-hot pincers, and then torn from his arms and legs. His limbs were broken to prevent him coming back from the dead before he was beheaded and then burned on a pyre. So they really, like, they really wanted to make sure with this guy.
They weren't taking any chances.
Like, yeah.
The funny thing, the thing that always gets me with these is that, oh, how I turn into a werewolf is I have a magic belt. Well, why don't we destroy the magic belt and not? Why don't we put the magic belt on the rack? Or the other thing is, you know, they intermittently turn into werewolves. Well, why don't we lock them up for long enough to see if that's true? And if they don't turn into a werewolf, then great, we let them go again.
It's very provable, doesn't it?
Yeah, but then again, I'm bringing reason to a knife fight. So
exactly.
You're bringing reason to a werewolf trial.
Yeah,
yeah. I'm very sad to say his daughter and mistress were killed as well, which is fucking rough because they didn't seem to be involved at all. Yeah. But as a warning against similar behaviour, local authorities erected a pole with the torture wheel and the figure of Wolf on it, and at the very top they placed Peter Stump's severed head. They really went to town on this guy.
But honestly, the people in the past, they were just like us. They weren't superstitious. They weren't carried away by the madness of crowds.
It was just all about community, wasn't it?
Got to remember that it was a different time. We can't place our modern value judgments on...
Yeah, which of us wouldn't have racked someone to a wheel and then slid their body through it? That's the werewolf of Bedburg. So I wonder if he even did any of it. to be honest, based on how spurious all of this is. But also maybe it was really obviously him, and so they went to town on him, because if you were there, you were like, yeah, this dude's really creepy and he's got blood all over him, let's get him.
All I'm saying is, broadly speaking, this is awful and barbarous and I do not approve, but if for one night only we wanted to bring back The Wheel as a primetime BBC One Entertainment starring Russell Brand,
Michael McIntyre hosted at the moment.
Oh, God, yeah.
That's what I assumed that show was. He got various celebrities and saw how long they could last under torture of spending time with Michael McIntyre.
Yeah, while still answering trivia questions.
Yes.
But also, very occasionally, you might fall off the wheel, like if your body just kind of slithers down, and that was seen as God granting you reprieve, and then you would be released. Like, you would be seen as like kind of surviving drowning as a witch.
They actually did let you get away.
It was interpreted as God's intervention.
Ah.
there exist votive images. I don't know what votive images are.
Like little prayer icons.
Right. Votive images of saved victims of the wheel, and there is literature on how best to treat such sustained injuries. I mean, I don't know how you're treating those injuries of all those broken limbs.
Imagine being the person who, at the end of like torturing you with the wheel, and then God intercedes, you're the one who has to come and go, oh, sorry about that. Here's some literature on how to make yourself feel better.
You're all right.
Yeah. Yes. Sorry that 90% of the bones in your body are broken. Here's a pamphlet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've been smashed on the wheel.
When people are executed as werewolves in the games you run, do you get them to choose like their method of execution?
So I have three methods. The first round is always hanging. Mm-hmm. I don't like doing it because it feels quite visceral, but it's also the most like ye olde village mob thing. Second one is guillotine. Mm. And then by the third one, we've lost all sense of occasion. So it's a catapult and they just get fired out of the town. I'm imagining a bit like the beer baron. Yeah. Being fired out of the town. So those are the three moments. If I ever do a fourth game, I sometimes have a little water butt that I drown them in, but that's really upsetting.
Yeah.
I don't like that at all.
Yeah.
It's just like their body twitching as their head is dunked. It's very bad.
Surely a trebuchet rather than a catapult just feels more on brand for that era.
Oh, yeah.
Also, Werewolf Trebuchet are an incredible prog rock band.
yeah.
Which are you going for? Are you going for the adorable Thai movie or the horrifying historical account?
I think because we've got some horrifying historical stuff from Barry as well, I'm going to go for the adorable Thai movie because I think that lightens the tone a bit.
So first of all, I'm going to talk about werewolves being a force for good in the 2023 culture wars.
Oh, we've got a werewolf apologist on our hands.
Yeah, as you'll both know, hate-filled, gammon-faced wrong'uns love to get angry when you show empathy for the way people would like to self-identify. And one of the current little hills that they choose to die on is non-binary people's use of the word they. Mm-hmm. And these individuals like to say, it's a modern trope, and how can you say that? And of course you can go, please do look at Shakespeare and the use of thee and thou. But the first use of the word they in the singular form is in a poem from 1375 called William and the Werewolf. According to Professor Dennis Barron, who wrote on OxfordEnglishDictionary.com, this is the earliest known instance of the singular they. In English it reads, because it's from a poem written in French, each man hurried till they drew near where William and his darling were lying together. And so, yeah, werewolves are on team LGBTQ+, which is not surprising given, you know, they're all about transformations. And also, this poem is an interesting example of a werewolf being transformed, not necessarily being transformed for good, but the werewolf not being an evil beast. And it's actually inspired by a 12th century romantic poem called Bisclaveur, by someone called Marie de France. And it tells of a baron who becomes a werewolf and can only return to his human form when he wears his human clothes. And when his wife finds out about this, he nicks his clothes so that he can never become human again, and then elopes with a knight. Bisclaveur survives for a year in the forest until he bumps into a king's hunting party, and the wolf runs up to the king and kisses his boot. And the king's astonished by this behaviour, and he calls off his hunting dogs and keeps the wolf as a pet. And later, at the castle, the king is hanging out with his court, and the knight who married Bisclaver's wife shows up at the party, and as a wolf, Bisclaver attacks the knight, but the king restrains him and scolds him with a stick. Later on, though, the king is travelling through the homeland with the wolf and bumps into the wolfman's ex-wife, and the wolfman attacks her and bites off her nose. And the king puts two and two together and goes, hang on a second, this wolf has attacked two people who are married. I think there's something behind this. And he guesses that something must have gone on. He arrests both of them. And under torture, the Baroness reveals the truth all along. And so the clothes are returned to the wolfman, who regains his human form, and his lands are restored to him.
Nice. Aw, the wolfman done good in the end.
Well,
just bit off a few noses.
Yeah, you got to bite a few noses to make an omelette or an estate.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're gonna pop back to the world of mythology in a minute, but can either of you tell me what a lykoi is? Lykoi.
That'll be a fish that's also a wolf.
It's a werewolf cat. So it is a very rare form of bred cat. Not by say bred cat, a cat that has been bred to look like that, not a delicious carbohydrate cat. but there are only 35 known examples in the world, and they basically look like one of those hairless cats, but with massive eyes and tufts of hair all over them. And allegedly, they behave in a more canine manner than a feline manner.
Just look them up. They look amazing.
They're real bizarre little alien things, aren't they?
Yeah. And do they go out killing on a full moon?
They do not. There is nothing violent or aggressive about them.
They're quite cute.
They are kind of cute, aren't they?
Because I find sphinx cats, the hairless ones, absolutely horrifying.
Yeah, repulsive in every single way.
Just disgusting.
What else do I want to tell you about? Oh, yeah. You mentioned before, one of you, about... I think, Barry, in Africa, they're being people turn into leopards rather than wolves, because the werewolf idea, the trope, goes all around the world in lots of different cultures, and you just transform into whatever is the nearest apex predator. So in the
which is a good choice. It's good choice that to not go, I'm going to be a were squirrel.
Yeah,
I'm going to really slot in at the bottom of the food chain. Oh.
Well, Barry, now that wolves do no longer exist in the British Isles, we would have to be the largest apex predator, which means that we would turn into a weir badger.
Yeah. Spreading TB far and wide.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Just going up to people going, you got any worms? You got any worms? Give me some worms and I'll go away.
Yeah.
But in the Horn of Africa, the most feared predator, particularly in rural Ethiopia, are hyenas. So there is local law of weir hyenas. So in Somalia, you have the Kori Ismaris, which literally translates as one who rubs himself with a stick, because that's how you transform yourself into a hyena for reasons unknown. But the real interesting one is in Ethiopia. What it is it traditionally it's believed that every blacksmith whose trade is hereditary is really a wizard or a witch. Now, blacksmiths having magical powers is also contained within European folklore, but there, the power they have is one to transform themselves into a hyena, and it's believed that they use that power to rob graves at midnight, that they feast on the bones and the flesh. The belief in this creature, that's also known as a Buddha, is also present in Sudan, Tanzania, and goes as far as Morocco. In the Berber tradition, it's believed that that there are men and women who nightly turn into hyenas and then reform their human shape. Now, sadly, as is tradition, gonna bring some anti-Semitism to the podcast, because famously, Ethiopia doesn't so much have now, a Jewish community there, and as it happened, many of the Jewish community there were blacksmiths, because strangely, the profession of blacksmith was actually looked down on as being a rather low profession, which I think is quite weird, because I think in European folklore it was seen as quite a skilled and, again, magical job. Because of that, it was one of the only jobs that Jews could do. And so what a surprise that the Jewish community of Ethiopia has been looked down on as being this bestial creature who feeds on flesh.
Hmm.
Let's talk about tomatoes instead. Because
where tomatoes?
Not weird tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe, but it was believed in quite a lot of text in the mid-16th century that tomatoes may be used by witches to turn themselves into werewolves.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it was believed that the way that witches bewitched broomsticks to allow them to fly was by smearing a particular flying ointment on it. And it was at this time, because of the travelling into the New World, that things like tomatoes came back. And a lot of herbalists and physicians and, I'm trying to think of the correct word, whatever pastor or biologist in those days, saw that there was a connection in the way they looked and behaved between things like hemlock and mandrake and henbane and tomatoes. And so they believed that if you ate too much tomato or you spread it on yourself, you may turn into a werewolf.
I can wholeheartedly believe that that is something that people believed back then. I foolishly just typed into Google tomatoes evil just now while you were speaking, and I have come up with tomatoesareevil.com. So it seems the belief has not left us as a race.
Yeah. I mean, basically, the reason why it came is because, obviously, the gentleman who much botany was based on at that time was Galen, a physician from ancient Rome. And at the time, it was still believed that, you know, the ancients knew everything. It was a golden age. They can't possibly be wrong. And so when this Pomodoro business appeared, they were like, well, either Galen's wrong, or there's these other plants that he has suggested may exist, but that haven't been found in nature. Maybe it's one of those.
Right.
And so Galen suggested that there were these types of plants that could be used for magical purposes. So when things like corn and blueberries and chocolate and tomatoes turned up, it was suggested that that's what they were.
Evil, and so evil produce.
Yeah, and so it was even, there was a mistranslation of it, of the Lycopersicon. And so it turned into being referred to as the wolf peach is what tomatoes were referred to for a while.
Oh my God, I would so eat wolf peaches.
Yeah.
Much more than tomatoes.
This debate continued well into the late 1600s. You had Louis XIV's botanist Joseph Piton de Tournefort accepted the tomatoes werewolfish name, and he went as far to call it as the red wolf's peach without ribs. And going even further into the 18th and 19th century, scientists were, particularly in Northern Europe, were very suspicious of tomatoes. Obviously, in Southern Europe, they were like, they are delicious. But up here in the uncultured North, we thought they were icky and gooey and possessed all sorts of strange properties.
I like the idea that they were suspicious of tomatoes. So someone brought in like a spaghetti bolognese, and then the scientist's eyes narrow.
Yeah, but yeah, they're very odd. Yeah. But before I give you my suggestion, I'm going to tell you about one more trial. This is sort of to lighten the tone against the tale you told of Peter Straub. So this comes about a century later, and it's a chap called Tees of Kettlebrunn. And this is a gentleman who was in his 80s who openly proclaimed himself to be a werewolf. He claimed that he ventured down into hell with other werewolves to do battle with the devil and his witches, because he claimed he was doing it because he was a hound of God, is what he claimed to be.
Oh, cool.
And he said that he transformed three nights a year to go and do this.
It's a dirty job, but someone's got to do it.
Yeah.
What a brave man to proclaim that in that day and age.
Yeah, well, yeah. He was put on trial because other people in this community claimed that they'd witnessed him rob a church. They thought that he was a werewolf, and he basically turned it on his head and went, "No, mate, I'm on the side of the Lord." So he claimed on the night of St. Lucia's Day and also the nights of Pentecost and St. John's Day, he and others would transform into wolves. When he was asked on how this occurred, he said, and this is a traditional thing, that they put on wolves' pelts that they had obtained from a farmer years before. This is where he was like, yeah, I did some naughty things. I'd go on other farms, I'd rip apart some of the animals, and then roast the meat and devour it. And the judge did come up with the same question that you would have of, if you're a wolf, how could you roast the meat? And so T said that at this point, they would transform into human form, roast it, add salt, and then transform back into the wolf form to eat the meat.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
That's just lazy.
It is a bit lazy. At another point during the trial, when the judge again said, I don't understand why, if you are a werewolf, you're going into hell to fight the devil. And this is where he said, you know, I'm a hound of the Lord. But he also said that the reason he went into hell as well was to go there to bring back the livestock and grain and fruits of the earth that had been stolen by witches. And he said, if I'd failed in my task, then that year's harvest would have been bad. So I'm doing a public service. I'm like, I'm a neighborhood werewolf doing neighborhood watch.
That's a Hallmark movie I would definitely watch.
Oh, God, yeah.
Neighborhood werewolf does neighborhood watch.
And the judge again got right down and said, okay, if you're a werewolf and you're on the side of the Lord, when you die, where will your werewolf soul go? And T said, oh, it's going to go to heaven. And the judge said, well, how is that possible if you're a servant of the devil? And Tees again said, no, I'm on the side of the Lord. So the judge listened to this, I imagine with a somewhat tolerant smirk on his face. And he asked Tees if he was a devout Lutheran and if he attended church and listened to the word of the Lord and he prayed. And Tees said he did none of those things because he was too old to understand them. Having gone through all these questions, the judge sort of lost his patience with Tees and went, you're a daft old man who is wasting court time. And so he got a local pastor called Magister Buchholz to intervene and just go, listen, can you just get him to repent for his sins and then we'll throw this out of court? And instead, Tees didn't listen to that, and he said, no, I'm on your side. I tell you what, I'll start healing the sick and injured animals. I'll do that. And the judge was like, no, just please get out of court. And in the end, the judge lost his rag with him and went, I'm not going to accuse you of cavorting with the devil anymore. I'm just going to accuse you of petty theft. And on October the 31st, 1692,
God, they love it.
They found that Tees was guilty of vexatious and highly forbidden misdeeds and wasn't put to death. Simply, he was flogged with 20 lashes.
Got away with it.
Brilliantly, before he was dismissed, another witness named Gurion was brought in to speak and asked if Tees was known in the area. Gurion simply replied, who doesn't know him? And it sounds like he just wants to waste court time and just yammer on to anyone about the fact that he was a werewolf. And
you're going, this guy.
This guy. And I'd be tempted to make him my choice if it wasn't for a gentleman who I'm going to tell you the very quick story of, a gentleman from Lorain County in northern Ohio. And this is a gentleman called Thomas Straup. And he was living on a caravan park and neighbours were complaining that he was in a drunken frenzy. He was starting fights with people. He was vandalising property. He kicked a dog cage in his anger. And so deputies came down and they found him passed out in his trailer, surrounded by swords and knives and throwing stars and a magnetic dartboard. And they woke him up and he started talking and he started speaking in a Russian accent and threatened to kill the deputy's cousin, Keith. Gentlemen, the deputy didn't have a cousin named Keith. And so they tried to get more of an explanation out of him, at which point he explained that he wasn't drunk, he wasn't aggressive, that when he'd been on holiday to Germany recently, he'd been scratched by a wolf, and so that whenever the moon was out, he was compelled to prowl through the night and attack anything that came near him.
Wow.
Only when he was locked up in jail did he go, okay, I drank too much vodka. I'm really sorry.
There it is.
Yeah. So, as much as I love Tees of Kaltenbrunn, his story is so adorable, I can't really have a go at him. Whereas this guy, Thomas Straup, is just such a lame, oh, I am a werewolf. Oh, no, I'm not a werewolf. I'm just a rubbish drunk. That I love him. Our nominees for the world's worst werewolf are Barry's Beast of Gévaudan, John's incredible Thai movie werewolf transformation, or mine of the Ohioan waster of police time.
I think it's a real smorgasbord of wolves there.
It is. It's an open and shut case. That transformation in the movie clip is something else. how they think they can get away with that is beyond me, but I cannot choose anything other than that. It's incredible. Just before we go, it's time for the world's best news of the week. And we are going to go to England, I believe, and tell you a happy art history story. So there is a 200-year-old painting, which is thought to have been a copy, has been identified as an original by renowned 18th century artist Rosalba Carrera. She was known as the Queen of Pastel Painting and was greatly admired by King George III. And the painting was left to the final Lord Edgerton of Tatton and then onto the National Trust, and it's been in storage for about 40 years, but it's been identified because of a unique slip of paper tucked behind it. I just love these stories of things that are thought to have been lost forever and have now been revealed to be a real thing by a rare artist who has been unloved. So it's a simple one. I'm just bringing a little bit of the Antiques Roadshow.
It reminds me of, I might have told this on the podcast before, there's a painting by Caravaggio, The Taking of Christ, which is quite a famous painting, which is in the National Gallery in Dublin. And until the mid-90s, it hung in the dining hall of the Jesuit Order's house in central Dublin until they had a guest staying in the house who happened to be quite an expert art historian who sat down for breakfast and looked up and went, "That's a Caravaggio hanging above the cornflakes and milk."
I love that. That was just his catchphrase.
Yeah, just it'd be stuck downstairs. They just thought it was a nice painting to have on the wall. Yeah, it turned out it was one of the greatest works of art.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Tremendous stuff. So, John, just before we go, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when you get there?
You can find me on Twitter at John Gracie, where I post about stuff. No Rolls Barred is the YouTube channel that I play board games on, which is a lot of fun. If anyone is a big fan of Blood on the Clock Tower, which is a bluffing game very similar to Werewolf, I'm doing a big event on the 24th of November where we're inviting a bunch of people to come and join us in a country house and play all weekend. There's all sorts of surprises. The theme is Gothic Christmas. Everyone's going to dress up. And there are some tickets left. Well, certainly the event won't have happened, so that is on the 24th of November. You can follow me on Twitter for all the updates on that.
I'm seeing if my bank account will allow me and my husband to go.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you should come. It's going to be so fun. We've got a big feast on the Saturday night. There's going to be all sorts of surprises as well. I cannot wait. It's going
to
be rad.
We'll have the link to that in the description of the episode.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Outstanding. Well, we are all off to stare at a dog until we turn into Apache Werewolf. until next time, goodbye.
Bye.